5:05 West Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Steve Norman reporting. In Syria, dozens of airstrikes believed carried out by government and Russian warplanes struck rebel-held neighborhoods of Aleppo on Sunday. Syrian Observatory for Human Rights said at least 16 civilians were killed, with a civilian defense worker saying the death toll may exceed 30. Meantime, the U.S.-backed Syrian Democratic Forces pushed closer to the Islamic State stronghold of Manbij in northern Syria. It is a key development, according to Indiana University analyst Abdul Qadir Sino.
This area where the battles are taking place is the corridor that links the Islamic State domain within Syria with any country outside of Syria, Turkey. And so it's an essential supply corridor through which the Islamic State often smuggles supplies and recruits.
Sino says the advance could create a political problem if Kurdish fighters, part of the SDF, use the territory to create a Kurdish state, something opposed by neighboring Turkey. At the same time, the Syrian army continues to move into the northern province of Raqqa, the de facto capital of the Islamic State's self-proclaimed caliphate. Sanagal Salad Osman, the Somali female journalist working for a state-run radio and television, was shot and killed in Mogadishu on Sunday. The assailants fled the scene, and there was no immediate claim of responsibility. Sagal Osman, said to be in her early 20s, was described as a rising journalist who was popular, a popular anchor for youth-related programs. She is the second female journalist to be killed in Somalia in recent months. This is VOA News. A veteran American journalist and his Afghan translator were reported killed in Afghanistan Sunday after coming under attack while traveling with an Afghan army unit in southern Helmand province. The U.S.-based National Public Radio identified the dead as phonojournalist David Gilkey and translator Zabiullah Damana. The 50-year-old Gilkey is described as an award-winning photographer and video editor and one of the first unescorted journalists to enter Afghanistan after the 2001 terror attacks on the United States. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry is taking part in the annual U.S.-China Strategic and Economic Dialogue that's going on in Beijing, urging China to find a diplomatic solution to tensions in the South China Sea. Mr. Kerry arrived in Beijing from Mongolia. The Beijing dialogue follows a three-day informal meeting of regional Asia-Pacific defense officials and security experts at the Singapore-based Shangri-La Dialogue. Analyst Anki Panda of the regional current events publication The Diplomat says China's position on maritime tensions has not changed.
China really hasn't shown that it's willing to engage in a dialogue at Shangri-La. We heard Admiral Sun Jianguo present China's position. He essentially restated China's longstanding position on the South China Sea, said that China doesn't fear trouble, suggesting that Beijing would be prepared to defend itself there. Trust remains very poor in the region between China and its regional neighbors in the United States.
Beijing talks also will focus on economic matters, cybersecurity, and climate change. U.S. Treasury Secretary Jacob Lew urged China today to cut excess steel production that he warned is distorting global trade. The body of legendary U.S. boxing champion, world boxing champion Muhammad Ali, arrived back in his hometown of Louisville, Kentucky on Sunday. Local resident Lauren Howard paid her respects.
Muhammad Ali has just meant so much to the city and to the world. And he's just, you know, not the greatest, not just the greatest boxer, but he's, you know, a great humanitarian. He's done so much for the world. And it's just great to be able to come and give him thanks.
Ali died late Friday at the age of 74 of complications from Parkinson's disease. Louisville will honor him with a procession through the city on Friday, followed by a public funeral at a sports arena. Former U.S. President Bill Clinton, comic Billy Crystal, and sportscaster Brian Gumbel are among those who will deliver eulogies. Get more news by going to our website. You can find us at voanews.com and on the VOA mobile app.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barton in Washington. Today's Monday, June 6th, and here are some of the stories we're covering. Liberia's President Sirleaf promises to consolidate peace and security as the new ECOWAS chairperson.
Instead of having Senegal sending troops to Mali in order to defend the situation against terrorism, we will be thinking about having the ECOWAS forces in one unified army, and it will be much stronger.
Ousma Sen is the director of the West Africa Research Center in Dakar. Burundi may reconsider its membership in the ICC if the body does not respect the Rome Statute. A group of Zimbabweans protest to force their government to tackle social and economic issues. And Ogoni people welcome the environmental cleanup plan of their region.
First and foremost, we see this as a victory for the nonviolent resistance that our people embarked upon for the past 25 years.
Labour's Ipi Abara is president of the Movement for the Survival of the Ogoni People and will remember boxing legend Muhammad Ali. Those stories plus Mark Oldman's sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Liberian President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf has assumed the leadership of the Economic Community of West African States, ECOWAS, promising to consolidate peace and security and calling on member states to work even harder to stem terrorism. A press release issued by the Office of the President also said President Sirleaf called for the conclusion of negotiations and legal actions to enhance trade integration in West Africa. The ECOWAS chairperson promised that she will work to improve financial stability. Ousma Sen is director of the West Africa Research Center based in Senegal's capital, Dakar. He said achieving monetary integration will also be an important step towards regional integration.
ECOWAS moving from here, I guess it will be consolidating the sub-regional organization. They are already talking about monetary integration. You will no longer be having Naira in Nigeria, CFA in Senegal, but it will be one currency, and this is extremely important because this will be going toward consolidating economic relations within the community. It's extremely important, and when you take that move, you are thinking of a possibility of getting ECOWAS and ECOWAS states being further integrated, which would be a fantastic step toward empowering Africa and the Africans.
Is the idea of a single monitoring unit for West Africa, is that a possible idea?
Absolutely. But that line is very short. We are talking about 2020. We are already in 2016. In the next 4 or 5 years, it should be something. Look, just imagine the number of countries where you have a CFA currency circulating or the CFA currency being readily accepted.
The new chairperson, President Sirleaf of Liberia, has called for the conclusion of negotiations and the legal actions to enhance trade integration.
Yeah.
What had been the problem?
You have a case in point. You have the problem between the Gambia and Senegal, the border being closed, not by the state, but the border being blocked by lorry drivers, truck drivers. Why? Because in the Gambia, they decided to raise drastically what it costs to go through the border and go through Gambia. So this is obviously a problem. The free circulation, the free movement of goods, and the free movement of populations sometimes is hampered by the constraints and difficulties which custom officers or policemen in charge of frontiers can create. All those problems can simply emerge from the lack of will of, you know, the people who are in power.
How can ECOWAS consolidate peace in the sub-region, particularly the issue of terrorism?
Yeah, they are thinking about having some integrated forces. Instead of having Senegal sending troops to Mali in order to defend the situation against terrorism, we will be thinking about having the ECOWAS forces composed of Senegalese soldiers, Nigerian soldiers, Ghanaian soldiers, Gambian soldiers, etc., in one unified army, which will be able to intervene anytime, and it will be much stronger. You know, they will have more weaponry, they will have more equipment, they will will be better trained, and they will be able to intervene wherever it is necessary. And they should be welcome wherever they go, not as any foreign force, but force which do belong to the sub-region. And consolidating or integrating that capacity for military intervention is a great step towards securing ECOWAS, towards securing Africa, and toward protecting the continent against any terrorist attempt.
Osman Sand is director of the West Africa Research Center. He was speaking with me from the Senegalese capital, Dakar. In Nigeria, the Movement for the Survival of the Ogoni People, MONSAP, has called on the federal government of Nigeria to take concrete steps to fully implement the recommendations of the 2011 United Nations Environment Program UNEP report. MONSAP made the call Sunday in commemoration of the 2016 World Environment Day. The report commissioned by the Nigerian government on the impact of oil extraction in Ogoniland found severe and widespread contamination of soil and groundwater across Ogoniland. The report recommended the establishment of an Ogoniland Environmental Restoration Fund with an initial capitalization of $1 billion to cover the cleanup cost. Last week, Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari launched a cleanup campaign of the region. MONSAP President Lebosi Piabara says the launch of the cleanup campaign is a validation of the nonviolent resistance launched 25 years ago when MONSAP launched the Ogoni Bill of Rights.
First and foremost, we see this as a victory for the nonviolent resistance that our people embarked upon for the past 25 years. And beyond that, we also see this as a recognition and validation of the issues that we raised 25 years ago when we launched the Ogoni Bill of Rights, amongst which we raised the question of the protection of Ogoni environment and ecology for further degradation. So we see this as a very serious victory and as a triumph of the non-violent resistance, particularly in the face of the raging violence agitation in the Niger Delta currently. Of course, an overwhelming majority of our people is happy with the development. And I think it's also a way to address the question of restiveness in the area, that at least for the first time, people are coming to a realization that those who conduct their agitation on a non-violent note can still be listened to, which, of course, is something that can conduce to peace in the area. And with a clean-up and the restoration of the land, there is hope that they can get back to their farms again. There is hope that they can go back to their fishing again. There is hope that several other economic activities that perhaps have been destroyed because of this can be brought back again.
Your organization has warned local politicians not to politicize the cleanup campaign that has been announced. What do you mean by not to politicize it?
Our point is that the point that we got to today with the president formally flagging off the cleanup of Ogoniland came about because a people at some point in their history rose up in 1990, precisely on the 26th of August 1990, with the launch of the Ogoni Bill of Rights. And every Ogoni person have been involved as far as that struggle is concerned. In fact, we believe that, from our experience, that no single Ogoni community does not affect them one way or the other. So we feel that everybody, irrespective of political affiliation, irrespective of religious belief, irrespective of any ideological stance, have to be given the opportunity to be involved in this process. We don't want a situation where somebody will tell us that because it is being done under a ruling party that is a different party and all that, because of that, some people have to be shortchanged or some people should not be allowed to get involved in the process. I think the point we are making is that everybody must be involved irrespective of who they are, what they believe in, or what they belong to.
Of course, there is this United Nations Environmental Report on Ogoniland. Do you think by the president announcing this cleanup campaign, that should satisfy some of the recommendations made in the United Nations Environmental Report?
As you recall, the report itself has just come. The report came because the United Nations Environment Program was invited by the Nigerian government to carry out an environmental assessment of Ogoniland. It was the result of the assessment that led to the report in the first place.
Lebosi Piabara is president of the Movement for the Survival of the Ogoni People. He was speaking with me from Port Harcourt in Rivers State. Today is Monday, June 6th, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Let's give a shout out to listeners on our affiliate station, Brela FM in Nigeria. Daybreak Africa time is 15 minutes past the hour. The government of Burundi says it may reconsider its membership in the International Criminal Court if the ICC does not respect the Rome Statute under which the court was established. Moses Javier Romana reports from Bujumbura.
Since the violence erupted in April last year, more than 400 people have been killed and 1,000 have fled the country. The International Criminal Court's prosecutor, Fatou Bensouda, has warned that those alleged to be committing crimes falling within the jurisdiction of the ICC could be held individually accountable. But Burundi's Foreign Affairs Minister, Alain Nyamitwe, says her stance goes against the principle of the Rome Treaty establishing the court. He says if the ICC doesn't respect the treaty, his country may consider its membership.
Burundi is observing, just like other countries in Africa, and following the steps that the ICC is taking in administering justice. We believe that this justice is not universal. Clearly, the African Union has come strong against some of the ICC decisions. Burundi being a member of the African Union, we have to fully back those decisions.
Among the ICC decisions that African Union has rejected is putting on trial acting heads of state. The president of Sudan, Omar al-Bashir, is wanted by the court for the crimes against humanity in the province of Darfur. 34 out of the 54 African countries have signed the Rome Treaty establishing the court, and ICC supporters say they are obligated to apprehend him. However, al-Bashir recently visited South Africa and Uganda, neither of which sought his arrest. Nyamitwe says the ICC is not respecting the principle of complementarity, which states the national courts are empowered to investigate and punish allegations of crimes against humanity and genocide. The ICC will investigate only if the national courts are not able to, or if the United Nations Security Council asks for the International Criminal Court participation.
We have told the ICC prosecutor that we believe that the concept of complementarity has not been respected, and yet that complementarity is provided for in the itself. Burundi as a state is not yet reconsidering its membership to the ICC, but should the ICC not respect what the African Union has been asking for, we have no choice but to follow what the others on the continent have come up with as an alternative.
Critics in Africa say that the International Criminal Court only was created for African leaders and that only targeted African politicians. The court denies the charge, though supporters admit that many international crimes are not investigated because many countries have not signed the Rome Statute. Moses Havyarimana, VOA Africa, Bujumbura.
Zimbabwean police Friday attempted in vain to disperse civil society activists who have vowed to camp for 16 days at African Unity Square in Harare to press President Robert Mugabe's government to tackle social and economic issues that they say are bedeviling the country. Patricia Mudadigwa reports from Harare.
The protesters vowed to stay put at Africa Unity Square for 16 days and 16 nights, saying the country's constitution allows them to conduct public demonstrations. This was despite the fact that the police were in full riot gear and driving around Africa Unity Square near Parliament of Zimbabwe in armored vehicles with water cannons. Section 59 of the Zimbabwe constitution clearly stipulates that every person has the right to demonstrate and to present petitions, but these rights must be exercised peacefully. One of the protesters, Lynette Mudewe, coordinator and founder of the Zimbabwe Activist Alliance, said they will not allow the police to drive them from the renowned place.
Right now, as we are having this interview, we have some of people from the state, so the government is listening. If they did not know what we were saying, they would not be sending their officials and riot police everywhere we are.
Linda Masarira, lead and founder of Zimbabwe Women in Politics Alliance, added that Some ZANPF activists also tried to disrupt their protest.
Last night around 7 p.m., about 12 young men came running in this park singing Munomaita Mutengesi and all. We ignored them because we know that when you are in a struggle, there are different issues that can happen or situations that they might want to provoke. But we are not here to cause any fights with anyone. We are just demanding answers, protesting against the government of this Zimbabwe, which has made us destitute in our own country. We are not here to fight with anyone, but we are demanding our constitutional rights as citizens of Zimbabwe.
The protesters are demanding jobs, saying the majority of Zimbabweans are currently struggling to make ends meet due to the harsh economic situation. Masarira said some Zimbabweans' youth do not even know anything about getting a formal job, even if they are highly educated.
Why are we in the streets right now? It is because of unemployment. There are no jobs in Zimbabwe. Zimbabweans are now destitute. Right now, if you go to the high-density areas, young boys who are supposed to be at the productive age are roaming the streets. How can we be a productive nation when 90% of the youth are not working?
The activists have different protest themes every day in an attempt to highlight most problems facing the nation. Reporting from Harare, this is Patricia Mudadigwa.
The body of legendary U.S. world boxing champion Muhammad Ali arrived back in his hometown of Louisville, Kentucky on Sunday. Ali died late Friday at the age of 74 of complications from Parkinson's disease. A motorcade to the funeral home was led by a hearse that had met the charter plane carrying Ali's body back from Arizona, where he passed away. Louisville will honor him with a procession through the city on Friday, followed by a public funeral at a sports arena. Former U.S. President Bill Clinton is among the luminaries scheduled to deliver eulogies. VOA's Calla Bob brings us the story of one of the most beloved and most controversial American athletes.
This son of a Kentucky painter took up boxing after neighborhood bullies stole his bicycle. His trainer said the boy, then known as Cassius Clay, grew to mix raw talent with determination.
A dynamite right, sends Archie Moore crashing to the floor.
In 1964, he shocked overwhelming favorite Sonny Liston to win his first world heavyweight title.
Short, kills him right to the jaw. Liston goes down.
Washington Post newspaper sports columnist Mike Wise says the confident boxing great continued to dominate, fighting with both his fists.
These represent dynamite.
And his words.
He was probably the first guy, the first athlete in America to brag about something and back it up. Nobody boasted in those days.
I'm the greatest, and I'm knocking out all bones. And if you get too small, I'll knock you out.
Clay had joined the Nation of Islam and changed his name after that fight to one that is revered around the world, Muhammad Ali. 3 years later, he was vilified for refusing the U.S. Army draft based on his religious beliefs and his opposition to the Vietnam War. Ali was convicted of draft evasion and stripped of his title, keeping him out of the ring for 3 years until the Supreme Court overturned his conviction in 1970. Just months after returning to the ring, new heavyweight champ Joe Frazier dealt Ali his first professional loss. But Ali later took his revenge against Smoking Joe Frazier and won their second fight. Another classic bout for Ali was against George Foreman. Ali and Foreman took their 1974 championship fight to the former Zaire in a remote part of Central Africa. It was a boxing match immortalized as the Rumble in the Jungle.
I have wrestled with an alligator. I have tussled with a whale. I done handcuffed lightning, throw thunder in jail. Bad, ain't it? Only last week, I murdered a rock, injured a stone, hospitalized a brick. I'm so mean, I make medicine sick. Bad, fast.
And for him to employ what people think still to this day is one of the most amazing strategies, act like you're tired, let the big guy punch himself out, and then all of a sudden galvanize yourself and find a way to knock him out in the eighth round. Well, that was still probably the most triumphant moment in boxing history.
The great man has done it!
Ali then met Frazier in their third and final clash. It was late 1975 in the Philippines, dubbed the Thrilla in Manila. Ali endured 14 brutal rounds and emerged victorious. The boxing legend's later years were plagued by Parkinson's disease, which he was diagnosed with in 1984. He could no longer float like a butterfly or sting like a bee, but his generosity and passion for humanity continued to inspire people around the world.
Muhammad Ali was beloved. You know, there was a heart component that I don't think anybody will ever touch.
Whether loved or hated, Muhammad Ali certainly made people feel. And that, perhaps even more than his boxing prowess, will be his lasting legacy. Carla Babb, VOA News, Washington.
It's time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. A very good Monday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports News, we begin with football. Hosts Zimbabwe dismissed Malawi 3-0. Liberia and Togo drew 2-2 as Ghana beat Mauritius 2-0 in 2017 Orange Africa Cup of Nations qualifiers on Sunday. The Central African Republic outwitted Angola 3-1. Kenya edged Republic of Congo 2-1. Swaziland pipped Guinea 1-0. Ethiopia beat Lesotho 2-1. Burkina Faso pipped Comoro Islands 1-0. And the Democratic Republic of Congo overwhelmed hosts Madagascar 6-1. Early on Saturday, South Africa overpowered hosts Gambia 4-0, Namibia pipped Niger 1-0, Egypt beat Tanzania 2-0, Guinea-Bissau edged Zambia 3-2, Senegal dismissed Burundi 2-0, Mozambique edged Rwanda 3-2, and Cape Verde Islands pipped Sao Tome and Principe 2-1. Elsewhere, African champions Ivory Coast edged Gabon 2-1, Sierra Leone beat Sudan 1-0, Mali outclassed South Sudan 3-0, and Uganda pipped Botswana 2-1. On Friday, Libya and Morocco drew 1-1, Cameroon edged Mauritania 1-0, and Tunisia outplayed Djibouti 3-0. Teams that have qualified for the Nations Cup so far are Algeria, Cameroon, Ghana, debutants Guinea-Bissau, Morocco, Senegal, Zimbabwe, and hosts Gabon. Meanwhile, Liberians remain confident they can qualify for the Nations Cup despite their 2-2 draw with Togo in Monrovia on Sunday. Talking to my colleague James Batty, Liberian coach James Salinas Deba explains.
As it stands, we're sharing points with Tunisia. We both got 10 points. Our last game is against Tunisia and Tunis. It will be very, very important.
How do you prepare for that kind of game? What are you going to tell your players?
It's going to be real hard because the matter of fact is we're playing away. That makes it complicated. We have to go and win. Not even a kilometer point. We have to go and win.
Talk about the game in Monrovia on Sunday.
We went up 2 goals, and then we, you know, at the end of the game, approximately 20 minutes at the end of the game, the entire league broke down, and we lost the chances that we had. So the game ended 2-2, which, of course, is not good for us.
That was James Salinas Deba, Liberia football coach, speaking in Monrovia, Liberia. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good day. And briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. Saga Sala Osman, a Somali female journalist working for the state-run radio and television, was shot and killed in Mogadishu on Sunday. Mohamed Ibrahim Mualimu, Secretary General of the National Union of Somali Journalists, told VOA that Saga Osman was gunned down by unknown assailants in Hodan District. And that's it for this Monday, June 6th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for starting your week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm James Barty in Washington, wishing you a very productive week.
Music time in Africa. Savor the flavor of African music. Hi, I'm Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Tune in, feast your ears, and dig in to an hour of amazing Pan-African music, featured interviews, and music news. Music Time in Africa, Friday at 0900 and Saturday and Sunday at 0900, 15, 20, and 2200 hours UTC.
Interested in deeper analysis of news and events in Africa? Then plan to join me, Douglas Impuga, on Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC. We'll have African journalists and expert guests discuss the topic at hand. We take a deeper look at important African news topics. So plan to be with us every Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa. Africa.